Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Hey everyone, welcome to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host Dan Weatherspoon, and we are going to talk historical issues within the church, faith crises, transitions that come upon a lot of us when we stumble upon historical or doctrinal questions, or sort of that mismatch between the official history or the overarching sacred narrative of Mormonism and perhaps the messier facts that are upon the ground. We're also doing this podcast right now at this moment as we're in the midst of a flurry of activity that surrounds a survey that many of you have been aware of in our podcast community that John DeLynn and associates put together to sort of why, for those of you who used to believe the church was one and only true church, and now you don't believe so, what were the factors that led to that? That survey has been in our awareness for 3 or 4 months. It's finally out, coupled along with Elder Marlon Jensen appearing at Utah State University with some religion classes and answering very frankly some questions. A recording of that was made and put online anonymously. Reuters and other news outlets have gotten a hold of that. And so we're now kind of in this mode of all these questions coming about. And our first guest, I'll just go ahead and introduce her or have her introduce herself to her. But Joanna Brooks was one of the people who in her Religion Dispatches article or her forum there at Religion Dispatches said, this is a moment. This is one of those times when Mormonism needs to step up to the plate and get on top of its history. So we're excited to have her talk about that. So Joanna, would you remind everybody a little bit about your background? And I first have to say, you're the most famous Mormon in America, at least today. Wouldn't you say?
The clock is ticking.
Anyway, Joanna, for those of you who haven't seen it yet, was profiled by CNN with Jessica Ravitz, who used to be a Salt Lake Tribune reporter. Yeah. So I got to know her a little bit when she was in town. But she's just terrific and did a great piece on Joanna. So I hope you're pleased with how it turned out.
I sure am. And it's great to be with you, Dan, on Mormon Matters. I love the Mormon Matters audience. And I am the author of a new book called The Book of Mormon Girl, Stories from an American Faith, which you can find on Amazon. And as Dan said, I blog at Religion Dispatches and Feminist Mormon Housewives as well.
Right. And we are going to have you next week talking about your book, along with Phyllis Barber, who's also a Mormon memoirist. Yeah. So we're going to have a great one. We were actually going to do that this week. And I have to do a shout out to Kerry Fouché in Arizona, who this is the second time he's just written me and says, Dan, you can't let this moment pass without doing a show on it. So we altered the schedule, and we'll have Joanna again next week to talk more about her book, and we're excited for that. So
that'll be fun.
But thanks, Kerry, for always being on my case. Phil Barlow, we're welcoming you back. I checked, and it was March 15th when we had you last time. So you were in the very third episode of Mormon Matters since I took over as host, and we're grateful to have you back.
Thank you. You're doing a good job. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's growing, and yeah, you were on the one with the King James Version and Mormons in the Bible and kind of our wrestling with some of the heading changes in the Book of Mormon, and it was a great discussion. Would you remind everybody the position you occupy there at Utah State University and a little bit more about your scholarly interests?
Surely. I was brought here as the Arrington Chair of Mormon History and Culture at Utah State University 4 or 5 years ago. Spent 17 years teaching theological studies or in a theological studies department back at Hanover College in Indiana before that. So my background is in the study of American religion and culture and history, and I stir around with issues like religion and human suffering and religion and the concept of time and scriptures and things, religion and space or geography, things like that.
Right. Some great production from you, and we're grateful to have you. Thanks for everything you've done in the past, and I know we're going to enjoy having you with us today. Scott Hawley, let me introduce you, or at least let me give you this much framing. Scott is new to Mormon Matters, but you're famous in the last few weeks, brother. You're a podcast star.
Oh, my word.
You were on Mormon Stories with John just a week or so ago, along with Ryan Cragen, talking about some surveys that he was doing. But we've brought Scott on as one of the team members, one of the main guys in doing the analytics and the number crunching and all that stuff on the survey that I mentioned here at the beginning. So Scott, would you give us a broader background of who you are? And
thanks, Dan. So yeah, I to that point about me kind of coming on the scene a couple weeks ago, my wife says I have kind of two speeds, one stopped and the other super fast. And so hopefully I'll be able to find a kind of middle ground here. But I have been very excited to be ramping up involvement in Mormon Stories and some of the work that John's been doing, and very excited to be on this podcast. I've been listening to all of your voices for a while now, and it's great to be able to say something to you guys and actually have you talk back. So this is exciting for me.
Well, thank you. And give us a little bit more about your background and your training.
Sure. So besides Mormonism, I also have a professional interest in another kind of arcane area that's getting a lot of press these days. I work in the private equity industry, which so you could say that I have some identity politics going on with Mitt Romney. But my background, I spent 5 years in strategy consulting, and then the past several years in private equity. I have an undergraduate degree in finance from the University of Utah and an MBA from Harvard. No PhD, so I'm the odd man out in that case.
Well, you're the one that has real-world skills.
Well, thank you.
Hey, and I just found you and I connected last week, and I found out that you're living in Mount Vernon, Washington, where I spent 7 months of my LDS mission, so...
That's right.
Fun to catch up with you about that.
Just relocated from Boston to the West Coast, so.
Great to have you. Well, you guys, let's dive in if we can. And Scott, I'm going to probably just turn to you first to help us get a feel for, at least in my timeline, I want to go from just the origins of the survey and a little bit about that. And I want Joanna and Phil to jump in with questions or, you know, things that they understand about it or just react to anything you say. But I want to go from there to the Marlon Jensen encounter at Utah State. And then from that, we'll draw lines to sort of this moment when articles are being written left and right. And it's just, you know, probably in a lot of our listeners' minds that, boy, I just want to hear some people reflect on what's happening right now because it feels like a big bombardment. So, good. So, yeah, please, Scott, take us away.
Sure. So this last fall, I guess it will probably come as no surprise to most of your listeners, Dan, that John DeLynn receives a lot of personal correspondence from his listeners, as I'm sure those on this podcast do as well. And not surprisingly, a lot of that correspondence tends to gravitate towards people telling their own Mormon stories and own personal stories about their faith crises. And a lot of those revolve around historical issues and social cultural issues and issues of church administration. So basically, John decided after receiving a few particularly poignant stories from people, including people who I think most people would say are leaders within the church, or at least are in roles that people look at as being leadership within the church. He decided to put this survey together. And basically what the goal of the survey was to get a better handle on who is doubting their faith, who is leaving, what some of the driving concerns are. I think that, you know, anyone who's spent time online and looking at these issues kind of has an intuitive sense, but where do they stack up against each other? Which issues are more important? Which issues are primary? Which ones are secondary? And then not to stop at kind of what causes it, but the paths that actually people take. So there are questions in the survey about who are you telling and how much are you disclosing? And then what do you feel? How is this impacting you in your relationships and your personal health? And then what paths do you take going forward, or what paths have you taken since your faith crisis? So the survey was designed this last fall. It was put out on Mormon Stories in the Bloggernacle. It generated a total of actually nearly 3,400 responses. 3,388 were were the total responses received, of which there were 3,086 complete responses. And as he was, as John was pulling these responses together, he brought a few people in, like myself and a few other people who have been really instrumental in pulling this data together. There, the 3,000 story or the 3,086 responses not only included kind of yes no on a scale of 1 to 5 type responses, but there are also three open-ended qualitative responses that a lot of people spend a lot of time going through and cataloging and tagging and trying to pull out the nuggets of information that weren't completely black and white. So the survey, as has been observed in some of the reporting, was not scientific. And Dan, as you mentioned, the full results were released last week, perhaps a little in advance of where I think some people would have liked, but because there was a lot of media coverage and because the survey the people who had participated were interested in seeing those results. And there is additional data yet to be released. Most of what we focused on in the initial release was cataloging what the big doubts and big drivers of disbelief were. Who people were telling and how they felt afterwards. What will be coming in kind of further releases is who these people are. There was some question, you know, perhaps predictably among people who were looking at the survey saying, okay, this might be representative of a certain group, but, you know, is this, are these leaders in the church? Are they not? Are they youth? Right. Are they, you know, just the internet folks? And I think that we'll have some good data.
Just the internet folks, those internet Mormons. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yep. Oh, love to dismiss groups, don't we? but
yes.
No, that's great to know that that's coming forth. So yeah, Joanna, you linked to it, and the version that's online really is incomplete. I've seen a little more advanced version, and I guess you guys are just, what when do you suspect that will come up, Scott?
It'll definitely be within the next few weeks. If it goes until March, I would be really surprised. But we have a release date or a release schedule right now, which we're looking to kind of align with some of the coming Mormon Stories conferences. There's one in Phoenix, I think, in a little over a week, about a week and a half. And then there's one in Boise in March. And for sure, by the Boise conference, we'll have the full survey data released.
And then do you suspect that there'll be a whole new round of media? Will you guys do press release? Will John and his team do press releases and things to
yeah.
try to get more media out?
Yeah, I think so. And there's a lot of things, as you mentioned, Dan, that are going on in Mormon Stories. And I think that this is part of it. And I think it's really an effort to kind of inform the conversation that we want to have take place online with additional types of content and materials.
Cool. Now, we're not done here, so you're going to still be the focus here for a minute. Joanna and Phil, you've looked at least these preliminary survey results. As we dive in, I just didn't have what caught you guys' eye, or what else should we say to help additionally frame this before we jump in and take a look at just some of the results?
One question I have for Scott is the political ramifications of the release of this survey in this moment, while the national and international media are focused on Mormonism. That
yeah.
was a surprise to you, but what comment?
Well, we haven't. So what I would say is, since the survey had more of a local release, with the exception of Joanna's linking to it in Religion Dispatches, there hasn't been, as of yet, much national attention specifically to the survey. Now, there was obviously the Reuters article and other pieces that we're talking about. You know, so far, I just interacted with John DeLynn, and we've had 7,000 visitors to the new website that was set up, Why Mormons Leave. And so I would say that so far, we would be pretty delusional if we felt that there had been much political ramifications. But you know, going forward, I really can't say. You know, I think that I can maybe turn that on its head a little bit and say, are we perhaps getting more notice and awareness from this on a national level than otherwise? And I think that that's definitely the case, but wouldn't want to venture a guess as to what the political impact of this would be.
Well, Part of my question would be, it's very new, and I would anticipate that the national media, all it would take is Joanna Linking or Jana Reese or any blogger that has a national audience, and they will get attached to it. And so I was wondering if some consideration were given to not releasing this in the middle of a presidential race.
No. I don't think that conversation may have come up, but not that I'm aware of.
And would you guys, your intention in doing the survey is not political, right? It's more like the natural evolution of the Mormon stories discussion. You know, you guys aren't trying to shake things up.
No, certainly not. And I would say that it's the question kind of took me by surprise because it's really not on people's psyche in terms of, you know, what that potential impact would be. Perhaps we should give it more consideration, but I don't think that there's not a lot of politicos among the group. We're pretty focused on what we're seeing in front of us and, you know, some of the reasons behind why the survey was released in the first place.
Mm.
You know, I think one other interesting data point to put in the sequence of events that have happened in the last couple weeks is the publication in the Washington Post of Carrie Sheffield's article from, I think she would identify as an ex-Mormon point of view about what she identified as shortcomings in the churches, you know, in the way she had been taught to relate to Mormon history and her own upbringing. And, you know, there is a, whether or not, no matter how folks time it, it just seems that there is a drumbeat, there's a pace picking up that we may not be in control of as this stuff comes out. And what I admired and why I was glad to see the survey data Scott worked on come out was because I think it offered more nuance and more more feeling, newer narratives than Carrie Sheffield's piece perhaps.
Yeah, and that's definitely what we were hoping to start was a real conversation, and I think that conversation has started. And I can talk a little bit about some of the reaction that I've seen personally, you know, online, and I've spoken to several individuals who have posted the survey and have had interesting conversations with family and friends. But it really was to use kind of a larger platform to spark a dialogue at a very local and individual and personal level.
And there's so much tension, I feel, you know, as someone who has a wide spectrum of Mormon people who relate to the Mormon tradition in a wide spectrum of ways on my Facebook, you know, I'm struck sometimes by the variations in tone. And there are just some folks who really need to be heard from, you know, who have left the church for various reasons. And, you know, I feel like one of the most important things the survey can accomplish is beginning to help people feel heard, because the dynamics can get fairly antagonistic when people feel like they're not being heard in the tradition, when the seriousness of faith crisis or its motivations aren't being appreciated and acknowledged. So, you know, anything to unplug the antagonism that sometimes creeps into dialogue between ex-Mormons and Mormons is, in my book, a very productive step.
Yeah.
It's hard to weigh that against timing, though. I'm very sensitive to Phil's comments too.
Yeah, and that's actually a really good point, Joanna. And I would say that the majority of the commentary that I've seen that's been positive has been from people who said, you know, taking this survey was just great to be able to say these things that I've wanted to say to someone who has wanted to hear it, and then to be able to present it. There's one commentator who said, "This is great. I sent this to my bishop," and the bishop was, you know, blown away by the percentage of people who don't tell their bishop. So, you know, he was doing the mental math of, gee, this many people have told me, that means that there's probably this many people out there who haven't.
Good. Yeah.
So, and we can get into some of the, you know, the other kind of areas that I thought was interesting, but I think from a response perspective, it really has been gratifying to see that conversation beginning to take place. And I think it will continue, and hopefully in a little less provocative and more dispassionate way than perhaps just a strict opinion piece would do.
Yeah, terrific. Joanna, when you mentioned Carrie's piece, I really had mixed feelings about it, but the parts that I really, because, well, first of all, she seemed to inhabit a different kind of Mormonism than me, or, you know, I framed it always in my life differently than she, so when she was getting certain messages, she was taken away I never would have, and things like that, so I couldn't relate to that, but I definitely loved the point that she was trying to get at, which was, you know, we're loving, we're friendly to anybody who's with us, but the boy, the second that you leave, the second that you doubt, it's blame, it's ostracism. And for her, it was let's quit demonizing people that begin to ask these questions. So that was my favorite.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so that's why I like the survey, too, and I'm with you, and I'm with Phil and his question about the politics of it, too, because I do want to, you know, the religion that I affiliate with to have its best chance to respond in a prepared way and whatnot, but on the other hand, I don't know that there, like you say, there'll ever be a perfect timing for something like this to come out.
Yeah, I would just say to that is that everyone who's worked on this is completely open to critique and suggestion, and believe you me, we've gotten plenty of all of the above in the last week, and we you know, I think it points to the intentions of the people involved that we're taking all of that in responding to the emails and internally having these discussions about, okay, what is our responsibility, what do we do next, how do we make sure that we accomplish the goals that are laudable without creating, you know, negative external consequences or letting the conversation or the process kind of get away from us.
Yeah, terrific. Now, here's what I want to do. Phil, I want to get to you and the Elder Jensen stuff and the Utah State connections. But Scott, because I want, after that, for us to really kind of, for those who are being exposed to issues for the first time with the news of this survey, and I imagine, you know, if Peggy Fletcher Stack, for instance, does a larger piece in the Salt Lake Tribune, there's going to be a whole lot of people that, you know, are reading this because she's the most, I think she's got the biggest following of all the authors at Salt Lake Tribune. There's going to be people that are saying, what is the Kinderhook plates? what's the problem with the Book of
right.
Abraham? I've never heard of this. And so I want to kind of spend the last half of our podcast today to process that and how some framings and things. So I want you to just give us a glimpse, if you wouldn't mind, at some of the key findings about what were the initial things that troubled people and that. And so maybe 5 to 10 more minutes of what's in the survey.
Sure. Well, real quick demographics on the survey respondents. 58% male, 70% married, 31% in Utah, and then the rest mostly U.S., non-Utah, although there were 9% international. Both education and income skewed higher than both national averages and Mormon averages. And then in terms of current attendance, 56% no longer attend the LDS Church, and 20% attend weekly with the balance roughly a quarter attending less often. So the kind of the headline piece of why people lose their faith, these were all these questions were given as respondents were able to rank whether it was not a factor, was somewhat a factor, or was a strong factor or primary factor. And there was no forced ranking. For instance, if you picked losing faith in the Book of Mormon as your primary factor, you could select another primary factor. So people could have multiple primary factors.
Okay.
So the top three factors overall in why people lose their faith were, I lost faith in Joseph Smith, I studied church history and lost my belief, and I ceased to believe in the church's doctrine and theology. I think that, you know, if we could go back and perhaps, you know, reword some questions, we would probably draw some finer distinction between those, because obviously there's a lot of interrelation correlation between those terms. And then a lot of observers noted the bottom three as well. And again, this is self-reporting, and we could have a very long discussion about the validity of self-reporting on personal experience in close-ended surveys. But the bottom three were, I wanted to engage in behaviors viewed as sinful, I was offended by someone in church, and lack of meaningful friendships within the church. Now, there actually were a number of respondents who did give that some weight, which, in my mind, at least, speaks to how seriously people were taking this and their willingness and desire to be honest. But those factors were the three lowest ranked factors. And I think if you asked certainly people who had been through the process, many of them would say that those were stereotypical answers of reasons that they had heard or had felt from members.
And it looks to me, I didn't take the time to add them up, probably about 20 different things. So you've given us six, but everything from women's issues to Book of Mormon to obedience, you know, lost confidence in general authorities, lose faith in Christ.
That's
all
right.
Those different things are in there, and they rank from what, moderate to strong factor. Some of them are just in the single digits, others in the teens, but I'd say most of them are 30-40% or above, moderate to strong factor, right?
Yeah, and that really gets to one of our big takeaways here, was that there was no single issue. And you see this in respondents as well, who basically said in some of the open-ended responses, for instance, that I have one here, he said, it's not any one of these historical issues, but the accumulation of them combined with the church's lack of addressing these concerns on their own. So there definitely was a lot of people who, you know, now perhaps if we had asked for force ranked, we would have gotten different answers. But, and from there, there were actually, we then went to historical issues. So taking away all of the doctrinal or cultural issues, just the three biggest historical issues, or the largest historical issues, of which there were, again, about 20 potential responses. And I think a lot of people certainly that were putting the survey together and looking at the results were surprised by the order here. The headline that Book of Abraham and polygamy were the two primary factors with and significantly outpaced other factors was picked up by Joanna in her piece. But I think there were a lot of people who were working on the survey that were surprised to see issues with the Book of Abraham ranked so highly.
Wow, yeah.
Phil and Joanna, what do you see in this list that you think deserves comment?
I guess I am not surprised by the list, other than I noted what you said about there isn't one thing that's ranking 75% of people rank it as the primary factor. The highest is 26%, with the Book of Abraham and polygamy rank it the highest. So I'm struck by that dispersion of causes. But with the exception of DNA, I think all of these issues have been around and on people's minds for many, many decades. And so there's not a surprise there. What seems to be sparking, I'm not sure if it's a perfect storm, but the seeds of a storm is the internet, the accessibility and spreading of the word of these issues that have been around for a very long time. And I also wanted to ask Scott or any of the three of you, if you've studied this more than I have, I've only looked at it and haven't studied it thoroughly yet, but who are people telling? You said, Scott, that one part of the survey was about who people are talking to. And
yeah, that actually was, I think, the most interesting. And I think as more survey results come out, what will really, I think, attract some attention is who is told and what the cost of telling that person is, how that experience differs dramatically from person to person based off of what their station is in life, their different demographics, age, et cetera. And there's a little bit of that in here that we'll cover. But in terms of who people tell, I think that a lot of people breathed a sigh of relief to see that only 5% of married people told little or nothing to their spouse. Or that their spouse knew nothing or little of their disbelief. I guess that still begs the question of whether it was the spouse doing the opening up or something else. But certainly spouses in general are appear to be, among at least this cohort, very open about their faith issues. Who is the least likely to know? Well, it's the bishop. and it's the ward members. And I think that observation has generated a lot of commentary and hopefully will continue about what is it about the way that we are structured as a community that means that the person who is supposed to be, you know, the spiritual leader and the person who people would think would be the person best suited to talk to an individual about a faith crisis, why is that person the last in many cases to know?
Yes.
So I think that was kind of the headline of the disclosure of the faith issues. The cost part that we put at the end, again, you know, from my mind was perhaps the most striking piece of this. And you can look and see how the level of distress that a person, again, this is self-reported. This is not some objective measure of happiness or stress or anything else, but their self-reported level of distress in their relationships with their parents, with their spouse, with their children, very significantly by their age cohort, by their income levels, as well as by their gender and their activity level in the church. And those last two demographic cuts will come in the next release. But not surprisingly, I suppose teens have a very high cost to their relationships with their parents when they disclose their faith issue. But perhaps more surprisingly is that the spouses who have the biggest, that there is a very strong direct proportion between someone's age and the cost of disclosing to their spouse, with those age 60 plus having nearly three quarters reporting that they have extremely high costs with their spouse through the disclosure of a faith crisis.
So this would be initial disclosure, not just the fact that we're still in tension over this at my age?
No, you know, that's a good question. I'd have to go back to the wording to see exactly how it is. In fact, let me just pull that up real quick. The question was, openness about religious disbelief can sometimes come at a high personal cost. What has been the cost of openness for you across the following areas? And then it asked the different relationships. So I guess it would be across the entire experience.
You know, speaking of relationships, Scott, I've seen a body of data that was not released in this press release that does some breakdown by gender on the different factors that impacted belief. And I've had this pet theory running about faith transition or faith crisis that motivators, not always, but motivators for men sometimes differ than motivators for women. And I noticed, you know, that there's a substantially higher proportion of men who responded to this survey. Do you want to speak to, you know, are you ready to speak to sort of the gender breakout? Do you remember that data?
We can definitely talk about that at kind of a high level. And I think that if we start at the top of the causes of faith crisis, social issues as opposed to historical issues tend to be more prevalent,
right,
and more primary for women.
That was my pet theory. Yeah, that was my pet theory running, that it was more likely for a man to sort of run into the credibility issues and have that precipitate a crisis, and more likely for women to have something in dealing with relationships. I mean, you know, you can't paint everyone with a broad brush, but I was noticing that, and I think there's some reasons why.
Yeah, and even among the historical issues, it was those historical issues where people were directly impacted, such as blacks in the priesthood and polygamy, where women had ranked those factors as higher than men.
Right. I think there's something about the credibility piece, like, for example, finding out things that complicate one's view of Joseph Smith or of the Pearl of Great Price, for example, that, you know, men who served a mission might relate to differently, you know, having given their life to
years
of their life.
Well, and the 60 plus segment was the most likely to lose faith in the leaders of the church today. So experience breeds contempt, or familiarity breeds contempt, or
and for women too. You know, for women too, polygamy. I just don't think polygamy can be, you know, understated as a burden or a pressure that women in the church still feel, and women relate to it differently, but it's a big issue for a lot of people.
Yes.
A lot of people just carry around a lot of weight about it.
And in the qualitative, that really came through, and we didn't explicitly ask for people to explain the answers that they had already given, but in asking questions like, what would you tell a general authority, or what would it take for you to come back, or I guess those were kind of the two big ones. A lot of women did bring up the polygamy issue. And just one thing before we move off of the gender is that across every relationship segment, women report a higher cost than men in being open about their faith crisis.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm.
Including to physical and mental health.
Yeah. Hmm.
Which, you know, there was quite a bit of debate about that. It was interesting when we had we had a war room set up one night when we were crunching survey data, and we'd come up with these answers, and you know, someone would pose the question, okay, you know, what do you think, men or women, harder or easier along this dimension? And you know, on this one of who is this going to be harder for, there was quite a bit of discussion with people being fairly split, because obviously men with priesthood responsibilities and leadership within their wards and stakes can have a fair bit of cost as well, and perhaps a more open and perhaps have more to risk from just an openness perspective, not being able to perhaps, you know, utilize their priesthood, whereas perhaps those costs might not exist for women yet. Mm-hmm. Women consistently still reporting higher costs.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Just the last three things I would say about these survey results, and this mostly comes from the qualitative questions. The three things that really stuck out in the qualitative open-ended question: one, more members talk about the betrayal or a sense of betrayal, and that actually was the word that came up most often, the betrayal at finding that the history wasn't what it set out to, even more than the actual facts about the history themselves. There were lots of responses of, I could have dealt with this if I'd been told, but the fact that I feel like it's been hidden from me is really what's pushing me over the edge. Secondly, and I think this will get to the discussion of what do we do now, people, when we were asking what would bring you back, weren't saying, gee, if you just disclose a little bit more, that would be good. It was almost to a person, full disclosure, open, complete transparency. And there really wasn't much wiggle room between, you know, what they saw as perhaps being no disclosure through official channels to full disclosure. And then the final one that we've already talked about, that there were lots of issues as opposed to single issues for most people.
Very cool. Well, we will link for sure to these preliminary results when the podcast release, and then we'll certainly link when the larger thing does, and I'm guessing Mormon Stories, and we may, again, get when we get into the more qualitative stuff there at the end, we may do this again. But it was great to have the framing, so thank you. So that's piece one for me, at least as I've set up this podcast. Elder Jensen is the church historian. It was announced that he will be emeritus this October and be replaced by, is it a Brother Snow? I should have looked at his name. It's Scott Snow or something like that. Phil, do you remember?
He is Elder Snow.
Elder Snow. Anyway, so we're going to have a transition there, but Elder Jensen has been kind of a favorite of a lot of Mormon, you know, Stories, Mormon Matters type listeners, because he seems to be quite open and transparent when you get in a room with him. he'll share a lot what he thinks. And Phil, would you tell us the circumstances that brought him to Utah State and sort of the nature of the meeting that happened there and maybe some of the more interesting things that he said, if you're willing to share those? And then we'll kind of talk to how that may have escaped the corral of the more intimate setting, and that's probably what's led to some of this, you know, what doesn't feel like the perfect timing for everything.
Yeah, somehow it got more sensational than I still am comprehending. I'm not sure why. I asked Elder Jensen. He was up speaking at the LDS Institute up here in a Friday devotional, and so I arranged for him to come over in a small, not widely publicized setting in a seminar room. We probably crammed 40 or 50 people in it, but it wasn't a big auditorium full of people, and it was not a It was not one of Phil Barlow's classes, as I hear it referred to. And he spoke for a few minutes in his gentle, winsome way, and then was entertaining questions. And one woman asked, a question was framed something to the effect of, are the leading brethren of the church aware that people are in anguish? Are they aware that people are leaving the church in droves? Do they care? And so Elder Jensen's fairly predictable, gentle response that was partly pastoral as well as honest was, yes, they know. And then he gave what is becoming his famous analog, saying, I have the sense that we're in the period of greatest apostasy in church history since the days of Kirtland. I think he either said or implied awareness of the internet and the connected, globalized world and rapid fire change of information these days. And so he didn't really say anything too sensational. Everything he said by my gauge was wise and non-defensive and open. Yes, the brethren know, and yes, the brethren care. It's on their minds. They pray about it, and they do discuss what to do about it and how the church can address it. And then he mentioned a thing or two, I think, in that setting rather than in smaller settings, but certainly that day he spoke of a thing or two that they in the history department are trying to do to take further action, to be open and non-defensive and confront problems and also distortions and assumptions about issues. And then a person in the room surreptitiously recorded the exchange.
Was there a sense that, was there an announcement that nobody should do that?
No. In the future, I will make it a point to say that that's not a respectful or perhaps ethical act unless one has permission. And so I learned a lesson that that would be wise, and that he said nothing that oughtn't be public, but a person ought to have the right to know that they're being recorded and that it will be posted in such a way.
Right.
So I was displeased about that, but the content of anything he said was perfectly fine by my judgment. So the person who recorded it posted it online, and it wasn't so obscure out in the churning seas of electrons out there as I thought it might be, but rather I had lots of inquiries from around the nation, and then finally from the Reuters reporter and other reporters since. So I think because Elder Jensen is the church historian and was being candid about acknowledging a concern among the leaders of the church, that intersected with a lot of other currents going on, including Mr. Romney's run for the presidency and the Mormon moment, and doubtless now the release of this survey.
Yeah, terrific. Joanna or Scott, from what you've read, were there pieces of Elder Jensen's talk that Phil didn't mention that you think should be brought up at this moment?
You know, maybe I'll just comment to the reaction that I saw online, which was, I think similar to the survey, a big breath of thank goodness from a lot of people who felt that they hadn't been listened to, or their voices hadn't been heard. The acknowledgement, I think, really went a long way and as a salve for people who felt that they had been, you know, belittled or demeaned through their faith trials by, you know, whatever forces they felt it was that was causing that.
I would just add that I've noted a sense of, among some folks I'm in touch with, a sense of urgency, you know, that Elder Jensen has been, you know, a great ally to progressive folks in the church, and his voice has been consistently reassuring. But I do get a sense of anxiety, and it's probably the year that we have ahead of us, which we can talk about in a little bit, that might be provoking it, as well as maybe just a sense, a general sense that there is something afoot in terms of members sorting out belief, and maybe, you know, and we documented rising rates of disaffiliation in one recent survey, very credible survey by Ryan Craig and Rick Phillips. So I think people are really worried. And as beloved as Elder Jensen is, there's just a hunger for movement soon. And we know our culture, and we know that institutionally, you know, pattern appears to be that, you know, we'll leave missteps kind of quietly behind and, you know, address them once and not really dwell on them. You know, for example, in the case of race and the priesthood, there hasn't been some extensive explanation or clearing up of old, you know, like the revelation came, everyone cried, it was good, it was quietly implemented, and we moved on. But clearly, right. You know, if that's the pattern, if that's the institutional pattern for dealing with thorny historical issues, I think people are hungry for something slightly different and very concerned. And so as much as Elder Jensen is trusted, I just get a sense of urgency that people really, you know, want to take care of other Mormons, regardless of whether, you know, regardless of what the church manages to accomplish. And we hope the church accomplishes, you know, what it has decided is the best way to approach this issue.
Good. Yeah. If I were to add my couple of observations from what I read in the Reuters piece and Peggy Fletcher's, he's definitely, all along, he's been fairly consistent that, yes, there needs to be reform to some of the things that are happening in church education that at a much younger age. So, for instance, he says, it's a different generation. There is no sense of kidding ourselves. We need to be very upfront with them and tell them what we know and give answers to what we have and call on their faith for like we do for all other things that we don't understand. He says the church has made no effort to hide or obscure its history, but these pieces haven't been emphasized often because they were not necessarily germane to what is being taught at present. And I think that's a good point. It's not the province of Sunday school or priesthood or Relief Society meeting to problematize it, but I do think he has a sense of we have to just get out in front of it with our manuals and teach it earlier. Phil, and I know you've interacted with him at a more of a personal level. Can you add a little bit more to any of the stuff that you shared already when you were more in reporting mode to just his persona, his, you know, how he acts, his compassion or whatever it is, but also anything that you would say, is he being stymied in some ways in progress? You know, are there certain factions of brethren with the 15 needing to be in unity that he ever seems to allude to, or you can tell it's heavy on his heart?
Oh, yes. I wouldn't want to try to psychoanalyze Elder Jensen or be his spokesman in public. Let him do that mostly for himself. But he is, it's clear from the whole history of administration in the church that these, the highest echelons of the church tend to be staffed by able, strong-willed, strong personalities who are not homogenized and not made from cookie cutters. And it's only been the past generation or two that their policy has been so strongly to speak with one voice. In earlier years, their individual perspectives were given more public airing. So behind the scenes, one can discern that, of course, Elder Jensen or others who are interested in adjusting how we teach ourselves about ourselves, how we teach the gospel in our classes, in our manuals, in our preachings, in our culture, in our educational system, in our historical department and writing, needs a kind of a revolution. And the history department has accomplished that. Not Elder Jensen, as wonderful as he is, and I don't know of anyone who admires him any more than I do, but he could be given too much credit, or rather others could be given too little credit, because he's the church historian, but a church historian cannot move, as we certainly learned with Leonard Arrington, cannot move unless he has
exactly
to trust the relationship of the wider body of brethren. Of course, there are contours and seams that could be explored there, but by and large, others, the brethren as a whole, get some credit, in my estimation, for supporting, negotiating the atmosphere that is there that Elder Jensen has done so much to help promote by wearing his authority lightly, by having his default drive be not defensive, but love and compassion and wisdom and recognizing insights of others and welcoming that. He's terrific, but others silently should get some credit.
Yeah, terrific.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think someone on Facebook recently referred to Elder Jensen as Obi-Wan Kenobi in that great line where Leia says, "You're our only hope." So I think there is a perception among certain people, and I think perhaps probably an unrealistic expectation, and probably, like you said, not enough credit being given elsewhere. But it is interesting that to hear that he is kind of aware that exists.
Thank you, Phil, for sharing all that. You're helping us. Yeah, he helps give a very human face, a very compassionate face, a pastoral flavor to him when he meets with people. That they're this, that, you know, he isn't one of the ones that will demonize you or question your integrity or something, but he listens. You can tell he's often moved and gets a little bit emotional when he's hearing of pain and struggles. And yet, of course, he's deeply fed by a spirit and a sense that this church is, you know, guided by God and guided by leaders. And I know he's doing his best to be influential in the best way that he can back there, but he also honors that his isn't the only perspective that counts. So I love that a lot. Now, Joanna, unless somebody has anything else, and feel free to loop back at any time on anything. Joanna, you were among the first, besides the Reuters piece, your blog post at Religion Dispatches kind of came out, and I thought did a really terrific job of framing this moment on the heels of the survey and Elder Jensen stuff. Would you mind summarizing kind of the main point that you were trying to make with that piece?
You know, I weighed in just on the heels of, you know, after Carrie Sheffield's piece came out in the Post and the Reuters piece and then Peggy's piece in the Tribune all came out within like one day of each other. And basically, I was also, and you know, I wrote a very sort of straightforward piece about, look, it's time. And, you know, without calling on anyone specific to do anything, because I really am not in the business of issuing demands at all. I'm not a church leader. I've never pretended to be. But, you know, just reporting things I've experienced and it was strongly informed. I mean, first of all, I want to set a context that, you know, among those of us who do end up speaking to the press, with the increased hunger for information about Mormonism, I mean, there's this very unique, because of the elections, and there's this very unique situation that Mitt Romney doesn't want to talk about Mormonism at all, and the church doesn't want to talk about Romney at all. You know? So in the middle, there's this gaping chasm, this hunger for, and this fascination and sensationalism on the part of the public. So, you know, there's a lot of demand for information, and already, you know, the stuff that's being written about Mormonism is more than I can read in any day. And Peggy Stack says the same thing. It's just, there's already just too much, and a lot of it's not good. But when those of us who do write for the public end up in front of a microphone, you know, we always get questions about polygamy. They always go directly to the hot button issues of the Mormon past. And they continue to define us, and there's no way around them. When you sit down, that's where they go. And, you know, I had a really powerful experience that is actually the background for the piece I wrote at Religion Dispatches. In one of the debates, Mitt mentioned his family in Mexico, and I had sort of tweeted out to people, you know, his family was in Mexico because they were, you know, committed to practicing polygamy, right? And, you know, I got responses from non-LDS people were not aware of that, you know, I launched a conversation on Twitter when I said, we need to talk about polygamy. Okay, everyone who's out here who has polygamous ancestors, I'll go first, you know, like, just say it, you know, because I have polygamous ancestors too, you know. And what followed was, it lasted like 18 hours. There was so much content coming through. I got put in Twitter jail, as they call it, because people retweeting people coming through and just dying to talk about polygamy. And so I wrote, and I had just gotten two questions at Ask Mormon Girl within, you know, the last week about polygamy. Do we really still believe it? Oh my gosh, I realized that this may still be doctrine, and I've been nauseated for a week and I can't look at my husband kind of questions. And so I wrote a fairly long Ask Mormon Girl piece, you know, and the entire thesis was, you know, we just need to talk about polygamy. You know, there's a range of feelings. Here's the historical background. You know, there are many, many young people in the church who have no clue that Joseph Smith had plural wives. They're encountering this information from hostile sources on the internet. We need to, you know, it's important to talk about it. It's just talk about it, not make it a subject of shame and silence, because when we do, we give other people power over us, power to embarrass us, power, you know, power to take advantage of us and make us look sometimes duplicitous or fearful or not forthright. And that blog piece got 7,000 hits in one day, which is a lot for me. That's a lot for my blog. That's several times what it usually gets in one day. And it now has like 200 comments, and it's just hits a vein. And I just got email from people saying, thank you just for stating that we need to talk about it. I mean, again, I am just a writer. And I trust that the people in charge of the church, they are in charge of the church. But there is just such a hunger to experiment with what I'd characterize as a more open approach to difficult matters or thorny issues of the LDS past. And, you know, the cost of not maintaining an open approach to those issues, you know, is in the conflict people silently carry internally, feeling isolated by it. And in the power it gives to those who would like to embarrass us. And, you know, again, just final comment, sitting around last weekend at a conference where Phil was too, about Mormonism and politics, the uniform impression from everyone who deals with the press regularly was that we are in for a lot of scrutiny in 2012. If Mitt does get the nomination, there will be a great deal of scrutiny at every aspect of church history. And so, you know, what can be done with compassion for our brothers and sisters in the tradition, you know, to produce the best possible outcomes? And I don't know what the answer is.
Or even what does the best possible outcome mean, you know, in terms of...
That's a great question, too. This is stuff that can't be done on a... You just can't turn around on a dime. You know, the habits that Mormons have developed of being guarded and self-protected and carefully managing our public image and the information we allow to go out about our community date back more than a century, I believe. And so this is not going to turn around on a dime in terms of moving from a fairly, you know, guarded way of managing our past to what I might characterize as an open approach to the Mormon past. I mean, there have always been exemplars of openness. And those who really know our history say it's no secret that there was polygamy or, you know, any of the controversies are no secret to those who really know our history. But what about young people? You know, it's a difficult question. What is the right thing to do?
Yes. And that's where I hope to spend this next 25, 30 minutes, if that's good with you guys. Now that we are talking about it, what do we do? Is it too late? Is it too late for the people who are going to be hearing for it right now? Is the church's apparatus going to be too slow in responding? Or what is it that we as a non-correlated wider internet community, blogosphere, podcast communities, what can we do to help ease this sudden thrust, this suddenly being thrust into these issues for folks? So I'd love to start with each of you. As I, you know, it wasn't deliberate as I assembled this panel, but it turned out that all four of us, as far as I know, are fairly well connected with the church. We're actively engaged with it. We're all probably quite aware of pretty much every one of the problems on the survey lists. And yet we're hanging in there. And so I kind of would love to know if there are framings that helped you at a certain point in your journey, or just from your own disciplines of literature, Joanna, or Phil with religious studies. Scott, you know, either your religious reading on the side or even your business and you know, those kinds of approaches. Are there things that have kind of made this inhabiting a new kind of relationship with the church and its history something easier for you that might give people encouragement? How's that for a throw out there? So, Scott, can I start with you?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, just a little bit of background. I identify very closely with the survey. I had my kind of initial faith crisis about 8 years ago, and it was completely related to historical issues. As a married white male heterosexual living in the United States, the church works really, really well for me, and it has for my family for a very long time. And I absolutely loved it, and I still love it to this day. I love it, and as you mentioned, I'm attending and I'm active, hold a calling. And this past summer, my kind of historical questions ran into some very practical applications as I was coming across some challenging situations in my calling as a ward missionary, specifically related to this issue of historical disclosure and what do we owe people who are signing their lives up to a belief system and to a way of life in terms of letting them know about things that, you know, I would have liked to have known earlier in my church experience. So when I kind of came up against those, I was really forced to take that historical issues plus the new issues I was facing and say, okay, what am I really going to do about this? How am I going to own my religious experience? And that's really when the Mormon Stories community kind of comes into the picture. I'm probably one of those who could say that it is because of this crazy experiment that we're all involved in each day of talking and chatting and posting and creating content and doing surveys, that I'm able to really feel like I am shaping a lived religious experience for me personally that is incredibly gratifying. And so I think that there's a lesson that can be transposed there to the institutional church, which is, above everything else, I think that the thing that our generation needs and wants, and I'm talking about our generation in the church, is the idea that we matter. I think we want our Great Plains to cross. I think we want to do something great and brilliant, and I think we don't necessarily need the church to tell us what to do, but we need to be allowed to do it, and we need to, you know, if not be supported in it, not be opposed in it. And I would say that the type of things that the friendships that I've been able to create through this community in the last 6 months have been stronger and deeper than many friendships that I've had, you know, my entire life. There was a post recently where someone said, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, that used to be when I ran into a member of the church, I thought I was running into, you know, a fellow war buddy. But when this person used ex-Mormon, but I'll throw in, you know, Mormon Stories Mormon or Mormon Matters Mormon. But when I run into a Mormon Stories Mormon, it's like I'm running into the person who was next to me on the beach in Normandy. So if the answer and it's true, it's, you know, within a couple hours or a couple minutes, you have a very strong connection, and or at least that's what I've experienced. So for me personally, if the answer is how do I, Scott, you know, take this historical issue, I just don't make it about history. I can appreciate the history, and I have learned to appreciate the history for its grays. And I think, you know, I think that the membership of the church actually has a significant higher capacity for gray than I think anyone gives them credit for. but it really comes down to the community and to the one-on-one interactions. So I think that if it's working, if you find a way to make it work functionally, and I think that this part is important, that the messaging begins to emphasize that functional truth, and that we'll see the historical issues. I think that it will be easier to manage those if people are focused on the excitement of the functional truth that they're an active participant in.
Yeah, I actually agree with that last statement quite a bit. That's terrific. I really have never thought of that. I want to matter. I want to be significant in some way, and I don't want to be discouraged from that, though I don't need to be totally, you know, embraced either. You know, there's some recognition there that the center of the church is at a certain place, and yeah, you and your full complexity maybe doesn't belong in every discussion, but yet you don't want to be discouraged from seeking, because I think it all feels to us when we step into these, we're stepping into more truth, to something that's good. We're on a forward lean that we're a direction we're supposed to be going. It's just, you know, to be told that we're wrong in that, that's so hard.
Yeah, and I would add that this past week, as we've had some of these survey results come out, and I've asked people for, you know, to share me some of the stories, and as I've heard of, you know, people having now a medium with which they can talk to their parents and not have the conversation be about them, but be about the issue. And to do it dispassionately and to open up. My own sister called me up this week and said, "Scott, I want to tell you my story." And she left the church about 15 years ago. And here I was thinking that I was all, you know, open, liberal Mormon. Well, you know, it wasn't until we began having this conversation online that I realized that she really wanted to have a conversation with me. And seeing those conversations, you know, and other people have told me this, that the feelings that they've had is they've seen some of those interactions occur have been, you know, spiritual experiences akin to what they've had on missions.
Awesome. Cool. Well, we're going to reserve the right to loop back to you as for more comments.
Great.
So keep your brain going. Phil, I want to turn to you now as our resident professor who teaches religion, and just ask you, what is it that you know, from all those tools of your tradition or of your academic discipline, what is it that you would say to somebody who's encountering these issues for the first time? What are some framings maybe from religious studies that help?
Well, this will be a little bit religious studies and a little bit Barlow, and we can grapple through and separate them where we ought. But I think that one way we go awry as a people is when we foster or accept or imbibe, breed a culture where inquiry is construed as threat and antithetical to faith, whereas I think faithful inquiry is of the essence of an organic and supple faith. If you can't inquire honestly, earnestly, passionately, but humbly, thoughtfully, and be within the fold, then you're either going to end up outside the fold, or a certain number of people are, or your faith is going to be brittle and ostrich-like. So questions are good.
Good.
Doubt is not the opposite of faith, but absolute antiseptic certainty is the opposite of faith. And I think most of the historical challenges that are on our survey's list here can be approached if we change some presuppositions, and two of them seem most elemental to me. One is that, as with biblical history, modern Mormon history in the 19th through the 21st centuries, Mormonism and the church has always consisted of human beings, and these human beings are not the embodiment or receptacles of all truth and perfection, but rather these human beings are trying to respond to the divine with which they've been touched, or with which they believe in faith that they've been touched. And that could sound, it is simple, but I think if you pay attention to that couching of attitude, all of these historical issues can be approached.
I agree.
It's just human beings trying to respond to the divine with which they've been touched. And we do that imperfectly. I do it imperfectly. My grandmother did it imperfectly. Joseph Smith did it imperfectly. And the flip side of that coin, in a way, because another threat seems to be washing through these historical matters, is a loss in the loss of the notion that the church is the one true and only church with which the Lord is well pleased. But it's important to remember that Joseph and Brigham and others, but Joseph towards the last of his life, last several years of his life in particular, taught in the direction of what he ultimately formulated in the 13th article of faith, and that is, if there's anything virtuous, lovely, or of good report or praiseworthy, we seek after these things. And Brigham says it is already part of our religion, which means instead of somebody having a truth and us feeling threatened and rivaled by it, that if an atheist friend has some insight, if a Buddhist or Catholic friend has some insight, that's part of my Mormonism, to welcome, seek, be, bask in the pursuit of the good and the true and the beautiful. So those two elements for me means, the first one means if there's all sorts of stupid stuff, superstition, prejudice, blacks and the priesthood, racism that somehow got formulated into interpretations of our scripture and then passed on by tradition, that can be understood sympathetically but rejected vigorously on the one hand. And on the other hand, if some people were ahead of us prophetically in shedding racism, then that's fabulous. I'll learn from and embrace that. And that's not a threat to my Mormon faith. That's a part of my Mormon faith.
Those are terrific. Now, of course, the church has set us up to not do the two things that you're saying need to be changed. And so is it too late, or would it be a simple fix for them to back off on one and only true, as well as, you know, more of acknowledgments of the human fingerprints? Or is this a task for the individual who's now, you know, getting confronted with this?
Well, I think we as a church need to address that, and we are the culture, and so I do understand what you mean by the church has set us up, but we're the church. It's not Mormon stories, it's not Mormon podcasts that are a new thing on the horizon, other than the medium, the technique and way of communicating. The earlier generation invented a sunstone, a dialogue. The earlier generation had a University of Utah Institute with the likes of T. Edgar Lyon and George Boyd and Marion Hanks and Lowell Bunyan. And all through Mormon history, there have been other elements. And in our scriptures, there are other elements. So I don't mean to negate that one single scripture, but it has taken on a life of its own in gargantuan disproportion to other elements in our scriptures, including, as I said, our canonized 13th article of faith, or 2 Nephi 29, that the Lord reminds us that I am the Lord of...
all the islands and everywhere in the world, yeah.
In the east and the west and the isles of the sea, and I bring forth my word in all of those nations. And there are many other passages we could turn to. So those are not less a part of our faith than other selective passages that we may tend to focus on. So we ought to not let ourselves be guilty of a narrowness that the Lord neither requires of us nor apparently tries to foster.
I love it. I say that all the time, and the folks that want to argue with me, it's like, Mormonism to me is what the said from the pulpit, what is in the culture right now, and I'm trying to say, but look at the scripture, look at all these injunctions, all these wonderful expansive things, and they're not quite making that connection. So you would say an encouragement to those who are coming to these issues for the first time is relax, don't identify the culture and the rhetoric ringing in your ears, even from your family, as this one and only very narrow way. Don't let that be the dominant message.
Well, that we ourselves can be apostate if Joseph is the person we're looking at. We can stand apostasy means to stand apart. We can stand apart from Joseph's teachings by ignoring them. So, for instance, if our popular culture demonizes the intellect, that's not what Joseph taught. Joseph taught that we are intellects fully as much as we are spirits, or sometimes he seemed to talk that our essence is spirit hyphen intellects. That's what we ontologically are. And to bifurcate those, to sunder the mind and the spirit, is to be apostate from a major thrust of Joseph's theology. So the point is to look to our own culture, our own tradition, our own scriptures, and find where we're taking the name of the Lord God in vain by trivializing it and sitting in our classes as though they were little scripts waiting to be enacted, instead of asking authentic questions that would magnify our callings and our souls and our minds. But finally, I don't mean to go on too long, we also need, as a culture and in our manuals and as we discourse with one another and in prayer, we need to learn the difference between a fruitless esoteric question that leads you into weird thickets and a good question that can enlarge the soul and our humanity.
Man, I could listen to you all day. That is some powerful stuff. Thank you very
Me
much.
Me too.
Nice. Either John or I need to interview you, Phil. We need to do an in-depth, yeah, the call. I can't even imagine.
Woo-woo!
Well, now, Joanna, your turn, and then I want you guys to all feel free to circle back if you have more. But, Joanna, what's your initial, calm down, don't jump off the cliff? You know, what is your strategies for somebody who might be in the wave of these surveys and what's still to come, meeting these things for the first time?
I think I just love so much of what Phil and Scott had said, and I would just also say that, you know, just as individuals face faith transitions, you know, entire religious traditions and movements face transitions. And, you know, anyone who's been through an individual faith transition will tell you that there are acute periods of crises that seem very disturbing. And then you come out the other side and you come to places of peace. And sometimes those involve, for some people, involve staying and leaving. And even that can change. I just think that, you know, Mormonism has this incredibly rich history. It is intellectually rich. There is so much powerful source material to work with. It's also a tradition that inspires a great deal of imagination. It inspires very intense social familial bonds. There's a lot of warmth between Mormon people. We feel strongly about being Mormon. You know, this is not a tradition that does not inspire strong feelings. People don't just leave them, oh, so what, there it was. You know, like one of the reasons there's so much feeling among, you know, recovery from Mormonism folks or ex-Mormonism folks is because the commitments we form to Mormonism are strong. And, you know, when I look at all those together, those all seem like, you know, the strength of feeling, you know, the power of the culture to attract and retain, the power of the imagination Mormonism inspires, the richness of its intellectual heritage. You know, we have what it takes to address these crises. We have what it takes. We absolutely do. And, you know, I love hearing Scott and Phil talk about, you know, Scott talking about wanting a challenge, wanting to feel like we matter. I mean, you know, I just hungered to be useful, you know, when I was away. You know, I was just like, I'm a thinker and a feminist and a writer, and I just want to be useful. Like, that's all I wanted to be growing up in this tradition, was useful. And it felt so painful not to be useful. And the thought that we could be useful, you know, at increasing the capacity of our own cult, of our own tradition, and I'll say that because I don't want to make it appear like I'm calling on the church or anything, but, you know, increasing the capacity of Mormonism to, you know, process ambiguity, you know, to tolerate it, you know, to sort out, I love what Phil said, you know, the questions that lead to greater knowledge and those that lead into thickets. And then finally, you know, we've always been a tradition too that's about it's about the primary experience, a primary encounter with the divine. You know, that is our origin story, is the young man who had no answers and went into the woods. And, you know, it's certainly these sort of experiences of the divine or the supernatural that kept me in my faith and in dialogue with Mormonism at times when that relationship was very stressed. You know, things I'd felt and experienced that helped the rest of it not become unimportant, but helped me ultimately process it differently. You know, knowing that every religious tradition has its baggage, that none of them are without complication, ambiguity, shifts from literal to different approaches and interpretations of scripture, text, doctrine, you know, that we're going to make it. It's going to be all right. I love the thought, though, of Scott. It just heartens me so much to think about, you know, what if the whole transition of Mormonism into dealing with a more open version of its history could be crowdsourced? What if we could all put our shoulders to the wheel and taking care of each other, you know, as we figure out how to be Mormons in the 21st century? That's an extremely hopeful vision to me. I certainly concur with Scott, you know, on the feelings of finally being useful, how wonderful it is to have, you know, this community you're fostering, Dan, and the one, you know, the Mormon Stories community, and just feeling a sense of purpose. And, you know, that oftentimes is the remedy to alienation and fear, is knowing that we are engaged in this work, you know, this movement, and the work will continue.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Dan, I do also think that for all of those things that I agree with, that there are, and including some of what I said, that there are dangers. I think Sunstone, that you ran for a while, if I were to write the history of Sunstone or Dialogue or various groups, I think that there have been times when they were intellectually and spiritually healthy and vital, and times when they were a little toxic, and
yes,
forums for whining and idiosyncratic unhealthiness. So I don't think it a given that we get this right. I think it takes both vigor and freedom and boldness and humility and gratitude, and we have to stay in conversation with ourselves in a way that strives for spiritual health.
Very good. I
love
that.
For sure.
Absolutely.
Now, I want to give you all a chance if you want to do another one, but I've got to pick up a piece on this because I was just having a conversation with some people earlier today, and this is a struggle. There's Joanna, you talked about the importance of having your own spiritual experiences. You know, Joseph Smith is our model. Go have your own experience with the divine. And I think for a lot of people who are meeting these questions, they're saying, you know, I had spiritual experiences, or what I at least thought were spiritual experiences, with this very clean, antiseptic view of the stone cut, you know, from the mountain without hands filling the whole earth, and even the things that look like hiccups really are for the greater good. Zion's Camp, you know, built leaders, you know, or whatever it would be. You know, we've got all these ways of framing it, and they've had spiritual experiences, and now they're doubting, how do I trust when it's a spiritual experience versus an emotional experience, or versus an experience that was brought upon by my desire for group cohesion, or whatever it is they would say. Do any of you guys have a framing about that, in your, that transition in your own hearts and minds, to where you've learned to qualitatively feel the difference between those?
Wow, that might be a whole other podcast for me there, but My quick answer there, and actually that is part of what I went through this summer, was trying to figure that out, and after I couldn't find satisfactory answers on, you know, differentiating spirit from emotion, I went onto the emotion side. And all I can say is, for anyone who wants to maintain a testimony, maybe don't become a neuropsychologist. but I will say that I got to a point where I was able to tell myself, God gave me a brain for a reason, and he gave me people that surround me for a reason, and he gave, you know, the people who have come before me brains and pens to write down what they're thinking. And so I no longer get as hung up on, is this decision that is coming to my head inspiration from God or from, you know, the cognitive biases that we all develop over time. If I feel that there is harmony, and I guess that's about all I could say on that. If everything is lining up, then we should feel that we can trust moving forward. And I think getting comfortable with a certain sense of ambiguity is actually fairly freeing. Is this the exact right choice? I have absolutely no idea, but I've done the things that I need to do, both, you know, spiritually, emotionally, and logically, to come up with a decision that I feel good enough running with. And the nice thing about having some ambiguity of the source of the information as well is I think you become perhaps a little more easy to course correct without hanging on to an idea that you know, maybe going against God's will. And I understand that might be not something that everyone sees eye to eye with me on that, but that's the model that I'm working under anyway.
Cool. Either of the other two?
I quite liked what Scott said. If we're going to have an experience of another person or a transcendent truth or the spirit, we've got to experience it, and we are creatures of mind, and we are creatures of emotion, we are creatures of spirit, but we're all wrapped up in that. We have all those dimensions of us, and we can't help but experience things and have them intersect with our emotion, even if they transcend emotion. So I don't think we should ask these questions, but I don't think we need to be embarrassed that there may be an emotional dimension to spirit, or there may be, it's often the best, most powerful love, or maybe one imagines Jesus facing his cross, not with emotion like, whoa, this feels like I'm right on track here. Sometimes we need to love. We love most powerfully when it's we're not right in the middle of emotion. A related and final thought, since we're trying to move on, is the modern church in the last half century has so glommed on to Moroni 10 as the controlling spiritual epistemology. You'll read it, you'll pray, and you'll know, and so then we go around like having a witch hazel stick in the ground of our own souls. Is this it? Is this me knowing? So that can happen, but we have all sorts of other models in the scriptures, like Alma 32, which is a more organic, pliable faith thing, or we have Matthew 7, by their fruits ye shall know them, or we have John 7, if anyone will do his will, he'll know whether the doctrine's true and of God or not. So there's a lot of elements that can go in there, not to be embarrassed about emotion, but not to be solely dependent on emotion.
Very good. Thank you. Well, those are all terrific. And you guys, I can just talk with you forever, but I really don't want these podcasts to always be these two-hour affairs. So let's kind of coming into this, as I said, this is just to talk to this moment. And so let's go deep sometime on spirit versus emotion, how to know epistemology. You know, maybe we'll have the same panel and we'll dive deeper and stuff like that. But is there anything that anybody has that is left on your table that you'd like to either sort of make your final summation at this point, and then we'll close the podcast with those kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean the last thing I wanted to bring up is one of the things that we asked at the end of the survey was, for those who have left, would you come back? And actually 20% of the respondents said that yes, under certain circumstances, they would come back. So I think that, you know, if we look at the membership of the church with an activity rate that's lower than 50%, non-active members are the largest segments of Mormons in the country. And we really have two choices on how we approach them. We can either look at the less active as simply fulfilling prophecy of apostasy. We can say that they were offended. We can say that we know a priori what's in their head, why they did what they did. Or we can stop and listen and potentially learn something that helps these people feel like they can come back to church, which I think whether you're a believing literal member who wants to build the kingdom or a less orthodox member who just realizes that some of those people that are out there are really the pick and flower, and that you would just love it if they felt that they could bring their company into the organized church again, that should be a goal that is worth pursuing. So I'd like to just touch really quickly. Meredith Lesueur, who has done a ton of work on the survey, actually just in the past hour pulled this together. And we looked at the responses to what would it take to bring you back. And as we talked about, a driving force behind many people choosing to lose their faith and leave was historical issues. However, interestingly enough, openness and honesty and transparency with the history, while that was something that people said as something that they would like to see in order to come back, that wasn't the primary one. That was the third of three. The second most impactful thing that people said could be done to bring them back was to be more accepting or to change certain social elements of the church or policy that these members thought were disfranchising. The number one thing that was mentioned was to create more room for less orthodoxy. Create room for people who weren't literal believers. That was the number one thing that people who have left the church said we could do to bring them back. And the most amazing thing about that, at least from the way I see it, is that does not require a revelation. That does not require even, I do think that there are some policy changes that have to be made for people to really be able to fill that. And I don't want to belittle those or say that those don't exist. I think that the temple and the orthodoxy filters that are put on that is something that is real and will continue to be an issue for this segment. But certainly the orthodoxy and as Joanna said in one of her podcasts, you know, correlating on each other, to the extent that we as members can create a space for that orthodoxy or lack of orthodoxy, not necessarily even to the accepting of those beliefs, but at the accepting of an individual and their right to worship the God according to their conscience. I think we have some evidence that that could be a place to start.
Thank you. That's terrific. Joanna, got any brain cells left? Any articulateness in your tongue?
I amen to what Scott said. And, you know, and part of it too, I think, is folks who do feel love for the tradition should take heart. And sometimes we have to just lead and claim the space, you know, and not be scared off when our brothers and sisters who are more conservative or literal say things that are not welcoming. I know it can be overwhelming, but, you know, it's there, and we can make it better for each other.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a theme of our last podcast about, and just knowing that you belong there. You've paid the price to be there just as much as they have. And even going back 2 weeks to my talk where I expanded my talk from Houston, those who are shutting you down are probably just doing it out of fear. And generally when somebody's afraid, you want to go and nurture them and help them not be afraid rather than simply get angry that they're expressing those things to you. And I don't know if we can keep those perspectives. I think that really would help. So terrific. Thank you. Phil, do you have anything to close with?
perfect love casteth out fear, John teaches us. God talks in, God is said to value in one not King James translation of a, I think it's a Pauline passage, I can't remember, but one passage talks in the New Testament of the rich variety of God's wisdom. So I like that image of a lot of wild flowers and vegetation of humanity and diversity on the one hand, while remaining sympathetic to the institutional church that doesn't want to dissolve coherence. And I respect the institution's desire to remain one church as the church goes so international. That's a tricky problem, to remain an identifiable, coherent entity and be loving and tolerant and welcoming of diversity, celebrating of diversity. And also we have the difficulty of one major asset of the church being a lay church. And so that means we have lay teachers and lay leaders. And so that's tricky to change everything. But I think we can work, if we don't get arrogant in the process, to enrich and broaden the culture and make it less defensive and more open.
Awesome. Hey, it is so great to have you guys all working together on this. Like you say, Scott, isn't it cool? Get a community going. And
awesome.
Yeah, this is important work, and thank you all for being partners in it. Joanna, where can they buy your book again? Amazon?
Yeah. You know, and we close the podcast differently when I come on. We say, look, support Dan if you can. contribute to this podcast, because I mean, it's just, you know, these are the places, these are the forums where we can go and begin the conversations that will change, you know, so much in the way and make us brave. I love what Phil closed with, not being, you know, perfect love casts out fear, you know, finding resources, finding the space to make ourselves brave again. This is one of those places. So show Dan a little love, give him a little support.
Thank you.
You're here.
But I do want them to buy your book, and they will enjoy the podcast next week more if they've already read it.
Okay.
So Amazon.com.
Amazon. Yeah.
And I imagine it's through Kindle's availability and all that stuff too.
Yep.
Good stuff. But the Book of Mormon Girl.
Yes.
Right? So instead of the Book of Mormon Girl, the Book of Mormon Girl, right? Is that the way you would say it out loud?
You could read it. You could read it either way.
Well, it's terrific. So, yeah, I loved it. So I can't wait to talk with you next week.
I have read this book. It's a delightful, delightful, fiery, good read.
Thank you, Phil.
Yes. Oh, very powerful. And Scott, thank you for bringing so much. And thank you for all the work you've done in the background, you and your team. Are you allowed to name all the names? It's John and you, and you said Meredith, the swearer. And
yes, and there's going to be some that I leave out right now. And I don't even want to say my team, because to Joanna's point, this is crowdsourced. It's messy and everything else, but certainly Travis Stratford, Morgan McCown have been huge. Meredith, I feel like I'm at a Grammys or something like this. Greg Rockwell, Todd Haddon, and I'm leaving off about a dozen others. So I'll make sure at some point we will give the full due to all those who have helped that I'm not mentioning right now. Dave Sontag as well. Has been genius with this. So, yeah.
Good. Sorry, I caught you off guard on that.
But no, that's great. It's been a really fun group to work with.
Nate, well, thank you for doing that, and thank you for coming on here, and thanks for being on podcast lately. Besides the one with Ryan Craig and his stuff, you also interviewed somebody else on a podcast.
Matt Martinick of the Cumora Foundation. He's got a great perspective on the worldwide church. So it's a great time to be involved.
Great. And Phil, thank you for coming again. And I tell you, you've made me want to have you a lot more often. Just the reminder of the power of your voice and your perspective. So I'm sorry, my friend, you're kind of doomed.
It's been a pleasure to be with all three of you. Thank you. And Scott, I enjoyed getting to know you through this medium.
And myself as well. Look forward to meeting you in person.
Hey, guys. Good night. Appreciate you.
Good night.
Thanks. Good night.
Good night. We're going to cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.